Welcome to the Irish Tech News Podcast, where we will bring you some of the most interesting interviews and features from the world of tech. Visit irishtechnews.ie and check out our podcast section to explore all of our previous episodes. You can subscribe to our podcast using whatever your favorite app or service is by visiting anchor.fm/irish-tech-news.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Irish Tech News Podcast. This is your host, Jamil Hassan, where I bring you the Crypto Corner, where I interview founders, entrepreneurs, thought leaders, artists, executives, you name it, in crypto and blockchain. And today, I have an amazing guest. He is the co-founder of BitCove in Ireland. His name is Peter Nagle. Peter, welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Jamil. It's a pleasure to be here today, and it's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Awesome. Pleasure is all mine. So let's kick things off. Let me ask you the first question is this, is what is your background, and is it a logical background for what you're doing now?
Sure. So my own background is in law. And when I first heard of Bitcoin, it was back in 2013 time. I was a university student at the time. And so it was my brother, James, who went on to be the fellow co-founder of BitCove. He kind of roped me into the digital asset ecosystem, into learning about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. He was doing a master's of computer science at the time. I think he was studying a cryptography module when he came across Bitcoin. So that's how it kind of started, and that's how it spiraled for me. Now, law, in 2013, I don't think it was like a direct jump. It wasn't maybe like 100% logical introduction to Bitcoin. But you know what? I think what we're seeing in 2020, 2021, the evolution of the regulatory aspect of crypto, you know, digital asset exchanges, particularly in the US and Europe, are starting to become regulated. You know, that legal side, and that legal knowledge is starting to become very pertinent and more apt. But even kind of outside of that, I think the background to people who are entering the digital asset ecosystem into Bitcoin, you know, it's become all encompassing. You know, maybe back in 2012, 2013, a logical background was computer science, but I don't really think that kind of applies today. We're having people from all different facets of society, whether it's economics, governance, computer science, philosophy. You know, we got this NFT boom, so people from the art and creativity industries are starting to come to the fore. So, you know, I think that's the great thing about Bitcoin. You know, we can blend these unique, diverse experiences, and people can make of it what they will. And it's become a great melting pot for, you know, for generating ideas, creativity, and progressiveness.
I agree. That sounds good. So what are some of the great things that you are up to at BitCove right now?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, we're an Irish-based Bitcoin exchange. So predominantly we offer Bitcoin. We do offer a range of other crypto assets, up to 40 different assets which you can buy or sell in a non-custodial manner. So what this means is you can buy or you can sell to us, and we don't have to ever have access to your private keys, or you don't ever have to entrust us with the security of your coins. So I think that's really important, and it kind of harps back to the mantra, you know, not your keys, not your coins. With Bitcoin, with crypto, it's revolutionary. It's such an evolvement from the traditional banking sector, but with that, new responsibilities come into play, and part of that is, you know, custodianship and, you know, having access to your coins and making sure you're trading in a safe and responsible manner. So I think that's a really unique aspect to our platform, and what we do is that we facilitate trading in a non-custodial manner. So someone could trade directly, you know, from their hardware wallet or even from their paper wallet and so on. So what we're kind of about is how can we onboard people, particularly people who might not be as, you know, tech savvy as the previous people who started to use crypto back in the earlier days, you know, and how can we reach these guys? And particularly what we try to push is the kind of personal support angle. I think sometimes the crypto industry hasn't maybe covered itself in tremendous amounts of glory in providing support to new users. So we try to assist customers in a human way as much as possible, whether, you know, that's over email, live chat, support lines where you actually ring and get real persons, or even just, you know, directly meeting one of our representatives in our offices. So I guess what we're trying to do today and what we're up to, we're looking to expand their platform outwards. We've kind of set our flag here in Dublin, in Ireland. We're looking to how we can, you know, increase our European presence. Obviously, the UK, our neighbors next door, because I think there's, you know, there's massive opportunities within the industry, not just for onboarding the next wave of customers, but also ancillary services, whether it's things like offering, you know, crypto debit cards, cashback and services. So a cashback services, you know, for spending your BTC. So I think we got some real cool things in the pipeline. And then, you know, added to that, if we look at what's happening in the crypto ecosystem as a whole in 2021, the DeFi, the NFT space, because we're all, you know, about lowering the barriers to entry. How can we make it more simple to get the next wave of crypto users onboarded? And, you know, it's about making things simple, making it accessible, making it human, and making it relatable. So that's things like looking, okay, you got your OpenSea, you got your NFT platforms, but how can we make them a bit more easier to use for maybe the people who aren't as tech savvy or familiar with this technologies? So that's what we're trying to do now. We're trying to break it down, make the next wave of innovation on Bitcoin and on crypto more accessible. So yeah, we're really excited about what we're doing, and yeah, we've strong plans for the future.
Awesome. So let's talk about the hot topics in Bitcoin right now. Sure. You know, this week there was a rollout. There was a new rollout. I don't understand it too much, but I'll get educated on it. It's called Taproot. What's Taproot all about? How does it work? What's the special thing about Taproot?
Yeah, so Taproot, it was one of the biggest or the most highly anticipated updates to how Bitcoin operates, probably since SegWit back in 2017. And so the overarching aim of it is to improve how Bitcoin scripts function. And in turn, this is going to improve the privacy, scalability, and security of Bitcoin and of the network. So it's essentially a soft fork on the network. Thankfully, it's been pretty much universally accepted among the different stakeholders, mining networks, exchanges, and so forth. If people haven't already adopted, they've kind of signaled that they will be in the not so distant future, and that's a great thing about Taproot, because it signifies that, you know, BTC, it's more than just an asset, or, you know, the narrative is Bitcoin the asset. You know, there's also Bitcoin the technology, and this technology can and will evolve. And this is just another example of how this is occurring. And maybe to, like, you know, break it down in real terms. So, like, what's actually occurring is that, you know, the Bitcoin network, it uses a variety of different features when making transactions. And some of these features make the transactions more complex than, you know, a standard peer-to-peer transactions, you know, things like time lock releases or multi-signature requirements, etc. And before Taproot, anyone could detect a transaction that was using these more complicated features, you know what I mean? So there wasn't a whole lot of privacy if you were using these features. However, with the implementation of Taproot, it's now possible to essentially cloak all the specifications of these type of transactions. And they will appear to someone from the outside that it's just, you know, a generic peer-to-peer transaction. But, you know, under the hood, it could essentially be a Lightning network, or it could be some sophisticated smart contract, etc. But, you know, for anyone checking off the blockchain, it'll just appear as a peer-to-peer transaction. And of course, you'll still see it going from one wallet and being received into the other wallet. That's not going to change. But I guess the specifications of what's actually happening within the contract, and if it's using some sort of, you know, more complex contract functionality, that won't be as obvious. So that's pretty cool, and it's pretty interesting thing that it does. The second thing is that it offers more enhanced smart contract functionality to the Bitcoin blockchain. So I think we've all, you know, the DeFi, the NFT projects which have scaled on top of Ethereum and Solana and things like that. It's going to give Bitcoin more room to operate in this domain. Now, it's not going to put Bitcoin on the same realm as Ethereum. It's not going to give the same exact same functionality, but it's going to enhance what Bitcoin already has on its base layer. So again, it's a positive development, and I think it's going to lay the foundation for future technical upgrades going forward. So maybe we don't have, you know, all the capability right now on the Bitcoin network, but, you know, go forward in the maybe the next round of upgrades, you could see a lot more exciting things happen. So it's pretty interesting what's happening, and it's a great again that you know, we're seeing Bitcoin as a technology continue to evolve. Sometimes it's hard to find consensus within Bitcoin because it's so, you know, decentralized. But it's great to see these developments starting to take place.
So you said something interesting there. You said Bitcoin as an asset versus Bitcoin as a technology. And then you mentioned NFTs and DeFi. Are you saying that with Taproot, we're now going to be able to mint NFTs on Bitcoin?
It's going to give a lot more functionality to people who want to develop, you know, DeFi NFT solutions on Bitcoin. I think the scale of it is not going to be sufficient to allow it to flourish like it has done on, you know, other networks like Ethereum. So I don't think we're going to see, you know, the amount of NFT DeFi innovation flourish like it has. It will give some scope, but it's going to be more limited. Where we're going to see most of the DeFi NFT innovation on Bitcoin is going to be more on layer two technologies. Things like the RSK network and other initiatives. So at the moment, it's going to be more layer two focused, I think, when it comes to Bitcoin, DeFi, and NFT. But what's, I think, really pertinent about Taproot is that it gives, although a limited scale for the execution of more complex smart contracts right now, it's laying the foundations that, you know, if we want to have another upgrade in, say, another year or 2 years, the foundation is there that we can build upon it and that we can start to, you know, enact further upgrades to the protocol and to the network that will enable even greater bandwidth for these kind of activities.
That sounds really good. So let's talk about what's currently out there right now, and that's you know, the current state of Bitcoin mining. What trends are you noticing?
Yeah, so in my personal opinion, Bitcoin mining in 2021, it's probably the biggest story in Bitcoin and probably one of, if not the biggest stories in the whole of crypto, okay? Like, we've seen a massive seismic shift in how Bitcoin mining or where Bitcoin mining is taking place. China recently decided that they no longer want the Bitcoin happening in the jurisdiction. So that was a big shock, I suppose, to the whole Bitcoin mining infrastructure. Because up until that point, you know, I think it was 60 to 65% of the Bitcoin mining network. And, you know, the Bitcoin mining network, it's a key aspect of the whole Bitcoin protocol. You know, that was done in China. So suddenly we had this infrastructure and it had to be, you know, shifted out of China and find a new home. And it has done so, particularly in the US, in Texas and other places like Kazakhstan. But, you know, it was really, I think, a testament to the robustness of Bitcoin that a geographical area which comprises 60 to 60% of the hash power for Bitcoin, that overnight it could, you know, drop to near zero, but yet continue on unabated in other jurisdictions. And again, the price, like if this happened back in, you know, 2015, 2016, this would have been the ultimate, you know, fear, uncertainty, doubt, you know, the concept of FUD, that China would ban Bitcoin. And I think the price would have spiraled to quite low. But I mean, the price just shrugged it off so easy. And again, it's testament to the robustness of Bitcoin that something so major could happen to the ecosystem and it can continue to develop, continue to operate in a manner which I now think offers more decentralization than previously, because we're not, you know, tied it so much into one geographical area, which, you know, is authoritative in its national, domestic, and, you know, policies. So that was, I suppose, the big story within the Bitcoin ecosystem over the last 12 months. Following on from that, I mean, you could kind of touch also on what's happening in Bitcoin mining now that it's moved. I think Bitcoin has kind of got a bad rep as, you know, this kind of inefficient, energy hungry type of payments, monetary system, and so forth. And I think a lot of it sometimes isn't entirely justified. And again, Bitcoin has phenomenal potential within the renewable, within the green energy sector, and the shifting of the mining operations out of China and into jurisdictions, particularly in Texas and the US. I mean, it's kind of rubber stamped that Bitcoin has a lot of potential to actually contribute in a net positive way to carbon emissions and lowering carbon emissions and making, you know, the green economy you know, work better and be more efficient. And that's because you know, Texas is it has the most abundant natural resources in terms of green energy in the whole of the US, and it's become the heartland of mining. And it's not really a coincidence, you know. They've got vast array of wind energy and wind turbines, etc. And these are all now being used. The spillover from these are now being used to mine Bitcoin, you know, because the grid can only take so much electricity. So when that happens, what happens to the turbines? They essentially have to shut down or power down and so forth. But now there's a second opportunity and there's a second alternative, and that is to use it to power Bitcoin mining operations. So that's a really kind of exciting progression. And I think it's something that we're going to hear a lot more about in the future as, you know, renewable energy start to come to the fore. I think it's particularly interesting in terms of domestically where we're in Ireland. Like, wind energy is in abundance, as you can imagine. Here we're an island off the coast of the Atlantic. We have got so much wind energy. As we start to step up our game in terms of, you know, producing more wind power, wind energy, we're going to have a lot of the same issues as what they had in Texas. They got all the spillover that they can sell to the grid. So what are they going to do with? Well, maybe they can put it into miners. Maybe it can start to generate Bitcoin mining activity and operations, which, you know, in turn is more profitable for the people who are launching these turbines. And in turn, you know, it increases the financial productivity of doing so. So yeah, it's just a really efficient way of dealing with this excess stranded energy. And I think this is real something that we've seen in 2021 with the whole Bitcoin mining operations. And it's something that's, I think, going to be very interesting going forward into the future as well.
I agree with you. And I've never been one who buy into that environmental, you know, inefficiency. I believe that centralized data centers like Amazon or so are far more inefficient. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, Bitcoin, it's holding up an entire monetary system, which is, you know, billions of transactions a day. And although it is energy intensive, it's energy also energy agnostic. It can use any energy source. It's modular. It's flexible. It can be transported on site. You know, a big problem with wind energy is it needs to be transported. Okay, so if you are generating it off the coast of Ireland and you want to transport it across the country, there's going to be inefficiencies in doing that. You're going to lose some of the power. And also coupled with that is the fact that, you know, it's the fact that wind power, it can't be used all the time. You know, if there's excess wind for the grid, it needs to be tuned down or turned off, and it's a very inefficient way of dealing with it. So Bitcoin can be powered by these sort of operations. So there's huge potential for it, and there's huge potential for Bitcoin to kind of sponge up the excess of this green energy.
I agree. So you mentioned China, right? And something that came across my desk, and I'm not allowed to interview them because they're in China, it was a delivery, recent delivery of brand new mining machines in Shenzhen, China. Yet the narrative was that all the miners are out of China. So there's a disconnect there, right? So what's really actually going on in China with Bitcoin?
Yeah, so for all intents and purposes, we're told Bitcoin mining has ceased in China. The government have came out, they've outlawed Bitcoin mining in China. Now, on the ground, what's actually happening? I mean, it's highly unlikely that Bitcoin mining has just ceased overnight in China. Now, I'm not directly aware of any deliveries into Shenzhen or anything like that, but I would be extremely suspicious, or I would be extremely I would be very, very confident that there is still a lot of Bitcoin mining occurring in China. There was, I think it was Cambridge, University of Cambridge had some data on the network. It showed the big exodus of Bitcoin power from China. You know, the hash rate in China went to near zero, but at the same time, the hash rate in other countries such as Ireland and Germany just grew, doubled or tripled in a very short period of time. So the question is then, I mean, has Ireland just had way more more number of Bitcoin miners in place? And the same with Germany, or, you know, is there something else at play? And I mean, the reality of the situation is that the existing Chinese miners who have decided to remain, they're just routing it through VPNs, pretending they're being in Ireland or in Germany, but the mining is still ongoing there. I think it's definitely taken a hit. I think that there's no doubt about that. But to say that there's no Bitcoin mining happening in China, I think isn't actually accurate. Particularly when you think of, you know, the existing infrastructure there, the knowledge there, and then you couple that with the record profits being generated by mining companies at the moment. I mean, yeah, I would be quite confident that there's still mining ongoing in China. But definitely, it's probably on a bit more of a covert basis.
So my follow-up from that is, globally, we have a semiconductor shortage, right? Semiconductors have a big role with Bitcoin. And what if, you know, what is going on in the semiconductor front so that to enhance the mining of Bitcoin? Are you aware of any new inventions?
I'm not personally aware of any new innovations there. I think we're all kind of familiar with the semiconductor shortage and how it's affecting mining and a whole host of other operations globally. I think there's a lot of the semiconductors and the production of them, a lot of them are kind of based in the geographical area around China, which would give them, I suppose, greater opportunities to, you know, get their hands on them and get them earlier. But solutions to overcome that, I wouldn't be 100% up to date at this time.
Got it. So let's move around. Let's move halfway around the world then, to the U.S. Right, the SEC just declined a spot Bitcoin ETF, right, and they've done so over time a lot of times. You know, what is the real reason other than, you know, the canned protecting investors excuse or response that, you know, the SEC is the real reason why they're declining the ETFs? And how could a Bitcoin ETF lead to widespread institutional adoption?
Yeah, so the Bitcoin ETF, it's been a big story around Bitcoin cryptocurrency circles all this year. And 2021 was hotly anticipated. You know, it was going to be year. A lot of people were anticipating that an ETF would be approved. Now, as it turns out, you know, of course, as we all know, an ETF was approved, but I guess not the type of one we were hoping for. The futures ETF, I think the first one by ProShares was approved, but yeah, we're still waiting for that spot ETF. And the market, I mean, it has evolved massively since, I think it was the Winklevoss brothers submitted the first ETF, spot ETF back in, you know, 2013 to the SEC. And yeah, we're still waiting on that. But, you know, regardless, I think the fact that we have the futures ETF approved, it's a step in the right direction. You know, ProShares, they saw a really strong volume on its opening day. I think it was the second highest or heaviest trading volume for an opening day ETF. So, I mean, it's indicative of the fact that there is interest amongst the institutional class for a Bitcoin-based ETF. But yeah, we still have some way to go. I think it's my personal opinion, at least, that the futures ETF, it's an inferior product. You know, with the spot ETF, the spot Bitcoin, it's actual Bitcoin, it's physical Bitcoin traded on the spot or, you know, with immediate delivery. So the price of the trade, you know, it's the price of Bitcoin at that time. Whereas with the Bitcoin futures ETF, which was approved. There's a whole lot more going on. It's more complex. I don't think it's as attractive a vehicle for an investment to its institutional classes. It's a kind of way, you know, to speculate on watching the price of Bitcoin will be in the future without having to own it directly. So I think most people in the Bitcoin ecosystem are still waiting for the spot ETF. Think it's better, more efficient way of interacting with Bitcoin as you're dealing with the Bitcoin here and now at this time. It's not about, you know, speculating and watching the price of the future, you know, at a certain date of time is going to be. So, you know, to bring you on to the next part, I suppose, of your query, why was it rejected? You know, it's hard to know for sure. Some people say that there's, you know, a political aspect to it, that the SEC don't want to be seen to be giving authority or the blessing over a spot ETF. You know, some people are saying that, the SEC said one of their main arguments was due to, you know, market manipulation within the Bitcoin ecosystem and on some exchanges. But, you know, that's not unique to Bitcoin. That happens across a lot of different markets. And a lot of these markets who have had incidents of market manipulation, they still had ETFs granted by the SEC. So it's a bit of an uneven standard if we're using that comparison. But yeah, like, still, I'm not unhappy about the situation, I guess. Futures ETF in itself is positive. But I think, yeah, the approval of a spot ETF is what the industry is really holding out for, and I think it's going to be a big game changer. It's going to allow a lot more of the institutional investor class get on board, and it's going to really lower the barriers of entry.
The school of thought out there, and I don't know how valid the school of thought is that institutions require, or some institutions require, the minimization of risk in order to get into Bitcoin. So the future is one where they can mitigate the risk down to almost zero, as opposed to a spot ETF where the price is volatile, is a deterrent. For an individual like me, I'm good with spot, right? But how valid do you think that argument is about whittling away the risk? And that's the main reason.
Yeah, I mean, It's definitely a concern, and it's probably part of the reason that I'm pretty happy with the futures ETF being granted for now. You know, I understand that when you're dealing with regulated markets, you got to kind of play by their rules, and you know that's perfectly fine. I don't really have any massive issues with it. You know, but like there's some risks inherent within all markets. You know, we've seen other markets, you know, I mean, the silver market, they had a lot of issues prior to the granting of their ETF. And still, you know, notwithstanding the issues that were being faced within the silver industry, I mean, it was still approved. So again, these kind of schools of thought, they're not wrong in a way that there is some risk with purchasing spot Bitcoin. But again, I don't think it's not unheard of in other industries which have been granted approval from the SEC. So I think it's a time we're just going to have to wait a little longer. I'm not too sure we're not going to get it this year, 2021. I'm not overly confident of 2022. But what we're seeing is we're seeing the SEC get familiar with Bitcoin. They're kind of dipping their toes in by granting the futures ETF. And I think we will, it's just a matter of time when we will see a spot ETF granted at some stage.
Thank you. So you mentioned 2021, and 2021 looks like my prediction is going to be wrong. Beginning of the year, I said Bitcoin's going to reach 200,000. We only have one more month to get there, but so it's probably not going to happen, but there is a something that happened this year, improvements in the Lightning Network. That was positive. So what do you see as the current impact of the Lightning Network, and how will it help us reach, you know, those six figures, maybe 200K in 2022?
Yeah, so the Lightning Network has been a big success story of 2021. It's a scalability solution, which is built on top of the Bitcoin network. And it's facilitating people to quickly send and receive Bitcoin for, you know, instantly for virtually no fees. So I think the Lightning Network is going to play a big part for the whole Bitcoin ecosystem going forward. You know, Bitcoin was designed as, you know, as an electronic peer-to-peer cash system. But as we know, you know, there's high fees associated with transferring Bitcoin. There's wait times associated with waiting for Bitcoin to be sent from one wallet and received into another. And, you know, there can at times be some network congestion. So this kind of makes Bitcoin perhaps not the most efficient payment system. You know, if you want to purchase a cup of coffee for, you know, $3 and you got to pay, you know, $1.50 or $2 as a mining fee for that, it doesn't really make it practical. So that's kind of what Instep, the Lightning Network, it's built as a, you know, a layer two solution where, you know, you and I, we can set up a channel on the Lightning Network and we can enter into an agreement to send funds back and forth or between other nodes without making an on-chain transaction. So what's, I guess, really great about it is that we can transfer Bitcoin from one to another or make payments for basically no cost. And it's permissionless and has the same base properties as in the underlying Bitcoin network. So the Lightning Network has been optimized for payments. And while we're seeing Bitcoin kind of narrative transition into a kind of global reserve assets, we're seeing the Lightning Network on top of Bitcoin, ensuring that Bitcoin still has the capability as a payment system. And it's kind of, you know, there's a network effect to it. You know, more people who get onto the Lightning Network and the more people who are using it, the more potential it has to succeed as a payment system and, you know, use case for everyday, day-to-day payments. I think we have like nearly 20,000 active nodes on it and over 70,000 channels connecting these nodes. So, you know, it's increased rapidly. Last year, it held just over 1,000 Bitcoin. Today, the capacity is nearly 3,000 Bitcoin. And, you know, if you think of that in dollars terms or euro terms, you know, the Lightning Network has grown exponentially. So, you know, as more people are using the Lightning Network, the capacity is going to have to increase as the Bitcoin is locked in there. So I think the Bitcoin Lightning Network can have a big part to play in the value of Bitcoin going forward. I don't think it's going to be like the sole driver if Bitcoin hits 200K next year, but it is an important factor.
And how does the Bitcoin's inflation also play a role?
Sure. So Bitcoin as itself is, I suppose, a deflationary cryptocurrency, is a deflationary asset. So over time, you know, it gets more scarce. And I suppose that's part of what's driving the value, because we live in a world at the moment where rising inflation is the norm. You know, we've all seen the surge of, you know, quantitative easing, money printing starting to occur over the last 12, 18 months, you know, in the face of the pandemic and in the face of COVID. And Bitcoin is kind of like a lighthouse or, you know, a shining beacon in these times of inflation. It has the opposite monetary policy that, you know, all fiat currencies have, in that, you know, we can't just arbitrarily decide to print off more money. And that's what happens, you know, in times of crisis, states, central banks, they will essentially, you know, get the money printer going and print their way out of whatever crisis or catastrophe that they're facing. And Ireland has upward of over 5% inflation as of October, and it's not really showing many signs of abating. So people are looking to, I mean, how can they ensure that their asset or their cash in their bank, how can they ensure that it's not, you know, eaten up over time, because, you know, inflation has really accelerated. And people are turning to Bitcoin. You know, it's a safe harbor. It's showing its robustness over the last 12 months. It's built in a way that it will develop as a deflationary currency over time. You just think of, I suppose, you know, there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin in circulation, but, you know, some of that's going to be lost to, you know, someone who loses their private keys or someone who dies without, you know, setting up any kind of inheritance or succession planning. So, you know, Bitcoin has this deflationary aspect to it that's making it seriously attractive to the people and to investors at this time when we're facing, you know, the highest inflation levels and, you know, 20 or 30 odd years. It's an interesting time for Bitcoin in terms of that. And I think it's a big part of why we've seen the price rise so strongly and accelerated so strongly this year. It's because people can see that the purchasing power, the capital assets within their bank, when it is in cash, it's been rapidly evaporated and eaten up by inflation. So Bitcoin is getting really popular as a consequence of this.
And then we talked about price, and I when I talk to other cryptos, I don't like to talk about price. You know, when I talk to experts on Bitcoin, I always, you know, want to know what your thoughts are as far as, you know, price in the near medium term. So what do you think?
So my price thoughts, I'm the same. I don't like to plant my flag as to the price of Bitcoin, particularly in the short term, because, you know, there's so many, you know, economic or social factors that can contribute to that. In the long term, I'm quite bullish on crypto. I've since I've discovered what crypto is and kind of fell down the rabbit hole, I've always been a big believer in it. Big believer in it as a kind of asset and also as a technology. What's happened this year and what's unfolded has only kind of solidified my belief in crypto. I mean, what happened in China and the, I suppose, the migration of nearly 60% of the hash rate to new jurisdictions, and for it to kind of go seemingly without any hitches, I think is a massive deal. And again, it's testament to the robustness of the network. So, I mean, you mentioned, you know, 200K. I don't want to give any specifics, but I don't think that's, I don't think that's a crazy price prediction to see over the next 12 months. It's hard to know. Bitcoin, it's still evolving. There's a lot of different moving parts to it. I'm pretty keen that Bitcoin, I'm pretty confident that Bitcoin can become, a reserve asset, much the same way gold has become. And if we look at the market cap of gold, if Bitcoin is to achieve that, it would be, you know, an asset worth nearly 500,000 per BTC. So Bitcoin still has a lot of upward potential. And I think it's just a case of when, not if, it starts to achieve this.
Awesome. Thank you. So I have one last question. I want to thank you very much for your time today. It's been a very insightful conversation. I enjoyed talking to you. And my last question is this: how can people find out more information about you, about BitCove, about what you do? How can they engage with you if they want to? How can they do that?
Sure. So we got a website, www.bitcove.ie. So if you just log in there, you can check us out. As I said, you know, we got phone lines, we got human customer support answering. You can give us a call, or you can email, or through our live chat or whatever. We're constantly, you know, posting out information on Twitter and Facebook, Instagram, trying to, I suppose, contribute to the knowledge within the sector. So, you know, someone can feel free to check us out there. We're pretty accessible as crypto or Bitcoin exchanges go. So we're not too easy to track down, and we're pretty easy to get in touch of. We'd be happy to hear from anyone.
Awesome. Thank you very much for your time today.
You too.
Thank you for listening to the latest Irish Tech News podcast. Check back every day for the latest episode. You can follow us on Twitter @Irish_Tech News, on Facebook, facebook.com/Irish Tech News, on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/company/Irish-Tech-News, on Instagram, instagram.com/IrishTechNews.ie, and on TikTok, tiktok.com/@IrishTechNews.